KOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KABU. Consider adding KABU to your will or add KABU as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KABU along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KABU to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kabu.fm to notify us of your plans.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
Yes, indeed. Be sure to stick around because we are going to be talking about some fun stuff today, relatively speaking. We had a very interesting trip that we went on recently where we were able to experience some things that we knew about, of course, but experience them up close and in person. And then we got a chance to experience some things we didn't know about at all. And what I'm referring to is we had a chance to visit the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And so for today's episode, we will be outlining our trip there and kind of explaining to you everything that we saw there. Well, not everything, but what we saw and really what we took away from that. There was a lot of people there having a similar experience, a shared experience. And so we thought, I think pretty early on into the trip, like, okay, we're going to have to do dedicate an episode to just this very thing. So today is that day. And also we have something that we want to share with you in our Way Black History Fact about a gentleman named Benjamin Banneker, who was one of the folks that helped design Washington, D.C., our nation's capital.
Wow.
Actually a very prominent player in kind of the way the nation's capital is laid out. There's a lot of really, really cool stuff about him that we're going to get to. And of course, he was Black. So we're excited to share that with you as well. And plenty of other things. But first and foremost, today we're going to talk about Ebony Excellence, as always, first. How's that sound to you, Q?
Shall we?
We shall. So today's Ebony Excellence is sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Media, and we are going to shout out a group of folks. It's a little different for us. This group of folks all come together at a location, so we're going to shout out the location, Norfolk State University.
One time for Norfolk State University.
Norfolk State University. An example of Ebony Excellence is if we've ever seen it. For those that don't know, Norfolk State University is an HBCU or Historically Black College and University. We had a chance to check them out in Virginia. And shout out to Wowie FM, W-O-W-I, out there in VA as well. But we had a chance to go to Norfolk State and hang out with Braxton and Khadija and Kathy and Maynard and Latif and ProShot, and I don't know her name, but everybody kept calling her light skin, and Dominique Garcia, all these wonderful, amazing people building an environment and a framework for the next generation of Black leaders and allies, and indeed intelligent people, because on the campus, although it's an HBCU, not all the students were Black. Not all the teachers were Black. It was a historically Black college and university, but a place where Black people are centered and Black stories are centered and taught. And the facilities are amazing. The campus is amazing and the people are amazing. And I love the work that they're doing. Q loves the work that they're doing. And we wanted to make sure that we shouted all those folks out. So shout out again to all the folks at Norfolk State. So, this museum, the National Museum of African American History and Culture. I wouldn't be mad at you if you haven't heard of it, because many people aren't into museums. And, you know, all of our listeners, we don't have a station in DC yet. It's coming very soon. But if you're hearing my voice, there's a good chance you don't live anywhere near DC. And so
if you're listening in Norfolk, you're actually pretty close.
Oh, well, I guess if you're in Norfolk, yeah. Again, shout out to Wowie. But, you know, many folks still don't make it to, you know, a museum like this. And, you know, one of the things that we saw while we were in DC was a building, and this is going to be funny to Q, but we saw a building and kind of engraved into the side of this extremely prominent, well-fortified building.
Massive.
Read the words.
Well-fortified building.
Yeah. But it read, you know, the National Archives of the United States of America. And I remember thinking, what a statement, what a thing to say, what a building, you know, just think of all the history. The National Archives are in this one building. Well, the National Museum of African American History and Culture kind of serves a similar purpose for Black people in this country. And again, we're very fortunate enough to be invited out. And the reason we want you to know about our journey is because it was very moving. So as I mentioned, when we first got there, let me paint a picture for you. So the building is kind of modeled after sort of a crown. Right? It looks almost like a crown, or that this is kind of what the design was supposed to be. I want to say it's maybe five stories, but the way the tour works, the way you're supposed to experience the museum is you start in the basement, right?
And they're very intentional with that too.
Sure, sure. So go ahead with that.
So it kind of takes you down into the bowels of the museum. It's a figurative and literal experience. As you're going down into this place, this big massive building starts to feel a lot smaller.
And the reason for that is, so they're very intentional about this. Mm-hmm. They will rope off the basement section. They have a long stairwell that goes down. They'll rope it off until enough people have kind of congregated waiting to go in, and then they'll remove the rope so everyone can go in. Now, while you're waiting, there's like a stairwell that kind of takes you down a bit further. And I remember
there's an elevator you can take too, but we took the stairs.
The stairs, right. And we're waiting with everybody. And there's a wall, and the wall is kind of backlit. And, I want you to go. I want you to see this for yourself. But on the wall is pictures of prominent events in Black history in this country. But there is a photograph, eye level, of Emmett Till. And he's looking right at you in his, you know, he never got to grow up. For those that know the story, we've discussed the story here on the show. If you don't know the story, please look up the story of Emmett Till. But, you know, if you don't know, he never got to grow up. So he's a forever 14-year-old, and you see his face and it's eye level. And I remember the feeling of wanting to reach out and touch his face. And you start to feel the weight of the experience that you're about to have. It starts to get smaller, as Q mentioned. So we're going down. We have our moment with him until, like, oh man, this is going to be intense. There's lots of photos there, but that was the one that we kind of focused in on. We get down. Now there's a group of us waiting to go in, right? So finally, when there's enough of us, they open the rope and we all pour into the bowels of the museum. And in the bowels of the museum, it starts with Black history in Africa and the slave trade, right? So the closeness of all the bodies huddled together, walking into this tiny space, you start to kind of get a sense of what it might have been like to be in a slave ship. It's very dark down there. It's not uncomfortable, but it helps.
It's intimate.
Right. And it helps kind of.
And we're going to keep using this word intentional because it is the best word to describe right. the way that the museum is set up. You're in a very, very close proximity with essentially strangers. And very, very soon into this journey, you find yourself having conversations.
You have to.
You find yourself sharing spaces. And this kind of feeling of stranger, and I think in normal times in a space like that, people would be uncomfortable, but in a different way, because this was uncomfortable, but it wasn't uncomfortable in an unfamiliar way. Again, it did not feel like we were now, oh my God, trapped in this room with strangers. It's like everyone in the room collectively took inventory of what we were learning and what we were seeing. Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of start really emotionally depending on each other. Like,
That's the right way to say it. So you're in with this, what, maybe 30, 40 people, something like that, you know?
Probably a little more, because I'm picturing this several groups of people that were around us, the conversations that we had with this young lady and these two young ladies and this family and this couple, maybe 50 people.
Okay,
right?
So 50 folks, right? And you walk in, and again, you don't know anyone, but you see people start walking through. Our intention when Q and I got there was to spend 10 minutes just kind of taking it in. We had to go see the whole museum, so maybe 30 minutes, something like that, to see just, you know, the each level, spend 30 minutes, and we're on our way. And it's not that kind of party. Absolutely not. You're
even
in there,
if you try,
this, it doesn't work that way. If you're a human being with a beating heart and you find yourself in the bottom of this museum, you will be changed. You see people. I saw people, black as I am. I saw people, Asian people, white people, having human moments, crying. People trying to educate their children. People, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The number of people there with their kids was probably the most inspiring part, because again, not black people, people for whom a certain faction of our country would have you believe we're not emotionally or mentally equipped to see or learn about this stuff. So parents of those children going out of their way to make sure, okay, if they're not going to teach you,
I'm going to teach you.
I'm going to teach you.
And then there's a place to learn it. And it's, and I'm going to tell you about it, of course, but I want to make sure you understand. It's heavy, but it's beautiful. We're going to talk about some heavy stuff, right? But the reason why this isn't a normal show where we're talking about heavy stuff, and that's just it. This is heavy, but it's beautiful, because the way they've designed the museum, I guess, again, everything is intentional. So let me continue. So you're down here, you're kind of maneuvering about, and there's exhibits on the walls, right? This is called The Journey Toward Freedom, and it's the 15th through the 21st centuries. This is the exhibit in the bottom of the museum. One of the things that you notice right away is there's literally writing on the wall of all of the slave ship manifests that they have records of. And that was something that was very difficult for me to see. I think that for me, how do I say this? When you think back to a person that died before you were alive, it's something, it's almost like a number. It's not a real thing.
There was an interesting moment when I noticed you noticing those.
Yeah.
Where I didn't understand what I'm watching Ramses. I'm in a separate part of the same room, and I look over and I notice that Ramses is troubled, and I can't really wrap my head around specifically why, except in this room, there are so many things that can grasp you emotionally. So him looking at words etched into the wall, I didn't know what about that specifically made him emote in that way. But I just knew that there was something. And then when I went over to join him and understood what he was showing me, it took about 10 minutes to just pause and mentally reconcile with what we were reading.
Sure, sure. So,
paint a picture of
okay.
Of what thank you exactly for that. We're reading.
So watch this. You go into this room and it's a museum. So there's exhibits, there's, you know, documents, there's books, there's papers, there's slave chains, all this sort of stuff. And almost as an afterthought, it's not the main exhibit. There's nothing that calls attention to it. It's just kind of sitting there in the shadows. If you make your way to it, are these manifests of the ships. And they're in tiny little lettering, and there's so many. They're all over the walls. They're not written in big letters that draw your eye in. You have to look for them again. And the manifests say the ship name, the country of origin of the ship, the date that the ship set sail, how many enslaved boarded, how many survived. That's actually the category, enslaved boarded / survived. And that number, slaves boarded / survived, the second number is always lower.
The second number is lower in 100% of the ships.
Yeah. And so we talk about slavery. We talk about Jim Crow. We talk about black codes. We talk about, you know, the history in this country. We talk about Rosewood. We talk about, you know, Black Wall Street. We talk about all this stuff, right? But the middle passage is what happened to human beings before they even made it to the shores. And I know that we haven't spent time discussing this because...
And that's not unique to us. There's not a lot of time spent on the middle passage, period.
Yeah.
Right? The history kind of starts with slaves arriving here.
Right.
And then there's an understanding that they came from Africa, but the journey from there to here, it doesn't get much narrative. It doesn't get much color. It doesn't get much context.
So watch this. To me, seeing this, it let me know exactly what it means to have our ancestors be commodified. Because they assumed not all of the enslaved would finish the journey. And these little manifest numbers are flanked by exhibits that showed how slaves were rounded up, and it shows how slaves were packed into the ships. And, you know, a little bit further along, there's a more prominent quote. I think you have to like get into the second or third room, pane of glass behind which all the exhibits and the things that you're supposed to look at are sitting. Mm-hmm. And this pane of glass says, here, go ahead and read it.
Negroes are a perishable commodity. When you have an opportunity, dispose of them for gold.
And this guy's name is...
I think it's Humphrey Morse.
Yeah, I was going to not say it. But anyway, and Q took that picture. He was actually showing me on the phone. I know you can't see us in the studio right now. But,
and that quote is from 1730.
Actually, I have it, the photo myself. But,
oh, wow.
But anyway, so immediately or at least for me, I got the sense of, whoa, you know, this is not Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn, where, you know, these folks are friends, you know, they're just happen to own us. This is like, no, you are literally property. You exist to, you know, we're trying to make money off of you, or avoid work, or whatever the case is, whatever their intentions were, motivations were for the slave trade. And it makes your stomach turn. You know, none of us were comfortable down there. But again, a bright moment, it was seeing other human beings have human experiences that were not black. You know, I could be down there all day and feel the weight of that and feel awful for people that lived harsh lives and died very short and were thrown overboard into the water, fed to the sharks because they couldn't survive that journey, or because they were whipped or made an example of, or whatever, to, you know, keep the rebellions from happening. But the manifest where it would say like 179 slaves boarded the ship and 83 survived the journey, you start to realize the amount of life lost at that point. There are some other things. These things were chronicled. There's a person that I read about in the maybe fourth grade, fifth grade. This is an argument for critical race theory, because I'm sure that his book would be attacked and challenged in terms of its value, its educational value. But a man named Oluda Equiano was a black man. Actually, I'll read from the exhibit. He was born a free African in the Benin region of Western Africa, son of a community leader. Equiano was kidnapped from his homeland and sold into slavery. He secured his freedom and went on to write a compelling personal account of his life. His story of sorrow, brutality, and resilience offered a deeper understanding of the human cost of the slave trade and helped to mobilize opinion against it. And they have a book of his from, I'm not sure when this book was printed, but it's like a very old book in the exhibit. And it was called The Interesting Narrative. And that actually was the book that I had to read. I think it was like the fourth grade. So, you know, we're walking through the museum. The next part is the human cost. The average lifespan of enslaved Africans who worked on colonial sugar and rice plantations was 7 years. Mm-hmm. Extreme physical demands relied on equally extreme instruments of torture to ensure control over enslaved peoples and protect plantation profits. Enslaved Africans were denied human dignity and the benefits of the economies and societies they built for others. So yes, so we're walking through, you know, and there's, you know, things like this on the wall, things, you know, documents, books, instruments, weapons, chains, all this sort of stuff.
Shackles,
exactly. And then, you know, we're maybe like halfway through and I see another one of those manifest numbers. This is a ship that came from France. The voyage began on 12/10/1730. It started with 170 enslaved who boarded the ship, and then one who survived. So 169 people lost their life after December 10th, 1730. And those were black people because they had been commodified. So that one hit different. And
can you imagine being the one that survived?
The trauma that you're taking with you, you know, who knows? But one of the things that also started to emerge as we're traveling through the bowels of this museum, because it's in chronological order. So we're going from, you know, the 1500s, 1700s, 1800s, you know, on throughout the American history, throughout the museum. But we get to a point where it's time to, it's around the time of the American Revolution. And the American Revolution, of course, is when America fought for independence from Britain. And Crispus Attucks was the first person to die on that. Then there's they dedicate a lot to telling his story as well. But there's another quote that stood out in this museum. It says, "It always appeared a most iniquitous scheme to me, fight ourselves for what we are daily robbing and plundering from those who have a right to freedom as we have." It's a quote from Abigail Adams, a white woman who thought it was strange that Americans were fighting for their freedom while enslaving Africans. And then that kind of sort of like kind of spits you off into the next part of the museum. So now we're past the the part of the middle passage. And there's a huge exhibit. It's called The Paradox of Liberty, right? And there are statues of the founding fathers. And on the wall goes up maybe 3-4 stories. And it's the Declaration of Independence. And it's like metal letters etched into the wall.
Before we actually get to the statues above the platform itself has an inscription. That inscription reads, "The Paradox of the American Revolution, the fight for liberty in an era of widespread slavery embedded in the foundation of the United States. The tension between slavery and freedom, who belongs and who is excluded, resonates through the nation's history and spurs the American people to wrestle constantly with building a more perfect union. This paradox was embedded in national institutions that are still vital today."
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more.
And now, proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
If you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are once again tuning in to Civic Cypher.
Indeed. And we are taking you through our experience at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. We will continue that in just a bit, so stay tuned for that, as well as the Way Black History Fact. Today we are talking about Benjamin Banneker, the individual who was charged with designing Washington, D.C., and us having spent some time in D.C., seeing how it's laid out, seeing the building, the old buildings, and knowing that there was Black hands that built those buildings is definitely something we're excited to share with you on today's episode as well. But like we always do at this time, let's discuss becoming a better ally, Baba. Today's Baba is sponsored by Major Threads, for the finest in men's athletic wear. Check majorthreads.com. And for today's Become a Better Ally, Baba, we would like for you to take a virtual tour. As much as we can talk about this, we recognize that radio is very different from other media, and we can't show you pictures, but you can't see them online. We can't show you videos, but you can't see them online. And of course, there's nothing that will top actually being there and feeling, you know, the weight, and having it change you and move through you. But I wanted to recommend a few museums that we know, we work with, and I think they're wonderful for you to visit. So first up, of course, is the one we're talking about today, the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Of course, you can find that online, but if you have a pen or otherwise able to write it down, it's nmaahc.si.edu. I know it's a bit wordy, but Google will get you there. NM is National Museum of African American History and Culture. SI, of course, is Smithsonian Institute, and EDU. So if you need to remember it, that's that. The other is the National Civil Rights Museum. I want to send a big shout out to Dr. Russell Wigginton, who's a friend of ours, friend of the show. He's the curator of that museum, and that is the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. King was shot and killed. You can do a virtual tour there at civilrightsmuseum.org. So we'd love for you to check that one out too. We think that you can become a better ally by doing that. And of course, the National Museum of African American Music. Henry Hicks is a curator there, another good friend of the show, and you can find out more at nmaam.org. So please educate yourselves. All right. So back to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So we were discussing the paradox of liberty. And that's a strange point in the journey, right? Slavery is still happening. Again, the museum is laid out in chronological order. So slavery is still happening. But now there's a declaration of independence for this country. This country is now not the 13 original colonies. Now it is a separate nation. And as they write this declaration of independence, and as indeed they write their constitution, they, meaning the founding fathers, who all have statues on this exhibit that we're now standing in front of, are being extremely hypocritical. Again, it's the paradox of liberty. That's what it's called. They are explaining exactly what it is that is inalienable, exactly what it is that they want, what they refuse to tolerate, so forth and so on. But they'll turn right around later in the day and impose their will on other human beings. And of course, at this point now, it's race-based slavery in the United States. It's not slavery just for the sake of slavery. No, all the black people are slaves or subject to slavery. None of the white people, right? Indentured servitude, you know, that sort of thing is fine, but you cannot be a slave if you're white, not in the way that black people are. No one's going to buy you and sell you. That's not, you know, you have rights still. So we spent some time there at that exhibit, and I know that one was kind of a big deal to you.
The thing that stood out most to me about this entire moment we spent in the museum is that even those participating in this moment in history couldn't help but to point out the hypocrisy themselves. This didn't stop them from perpetuating it. But even they noticed, this is kind of weird. But it goes back to commodifying us. No, this stuff that we're talking about is for men.
Yeah.
These rights and freedoms, this is for men. Those aren't men. Those aren't people. That's our property. This is strengthening our right to our property. These freedoms that all men are promised are helping us bolster the subjugation of our commodities over here. It's necessary for us to do this to protect ourselves and our property, not their homes, and I was going to say not their cattle, but I think they very, very much considered us very similar.
Oh, yeah.
To their cattle. And again, we make note of the speed or lack thereof with regard to progress in this country. We can't pretend we haven't made any.
That's fair. Yeah.
But we can be insulted by it. It's like it stopped at some point.
Yeah.
Got to a point where things were just good enough, and that passion to fight for more seemingly dissipated.
Well, not around here. All right. So we move on, and you know, it continues telling the story. Now, obviously, it's its own country. It's the United States of America. Now, you know, and then slaves, of course, it's illegal to teach people who are black to read and write. That didn't stop black people from learning. And leaving behind stories. And so some of these stories are in the museum. And so you get a glimpse into what life is like as a slave. I remember there's like an audio recording of a woman who was recalling what it feels like to be at a slave auction. And she's like, you know, I'm standing there naked, and these white, strange white men, they come up to me and they grab on my naked body and they feel on me, and then they grab my head, and then they roll my eyes up so they can see the whites of my eyes, and then they pull my lips down to look at my teeth, and then they turn my head side to side and they examine, you know, my body, and then they bid on me, and everyone is watching while this is happening. And there's another quote, excerpt from a writer named is Elizabeth Freeman. And this is very powerful. When you see it, you know, when you see how they've presented it to the visitor of the museum, then you kind of get a little bit more of the weight of it. But it says, if 1 minute's freedom had been offered to me and I had been told I must die at the end of that minute, I would have taken it. Mm. So that gives you a sense of exactly what these human beings were dealing with. 1 minute of freedom and I had to die at the end of it, I would have taken it. There's a lot to be said about her, but actually, you know what? I'll share a story. She deserves to for you to know about her. Elizabeth Freeman, known as Mom Bet, was born into slavery and was one of the first people to successfully sue for her freedom in the new nation. Freeman was a Revolutionary War widow enslaved by John Ashley, a powerful Massachusetts attorney. When she overheard a discussion about the Massachusetts Constitution, she seized on its guarantee of liberty to bring her lawsuit. Her claim to freedom changed her life and helped end slavery in Massachusetts. So that's who said that if she had lived 1 minute free and then died at the end of it, she would take it. Then other popular names to those of us who have been able to learn a little bit about our history. We learned a little bit about Nat Turner. If you don't know about Nat Turner, he's a person who's perhaps mostly known for a slave revolt and you take it by force, you know. And it's important to know his name. You know, a lot of non-black people look at him and be like, well, he was killing white folks. And I don't know that that was his mission as much as it was killing the enslavers. But Nat Turner is not a bad guy. He's a person, he's a human being who's sought his customary freedom, as any creature endowed with consciousness may seek to do. One of the things that was really special that we got to see is Harriet Tubman's handkerchief and her hymnal. I have no idea how the museum has this, but it's there. And it tells, you know, the story about Harriet Tubman, and to be that close to that type of history, you know, and you might not think that's that special. A handkerchief, you know what I mean? That's, what is that? A hymnal? That, what is that? But think about, you know, these are human beings that weren't allowed to own anything. These are, you know what I'm saying? So anything they left behind, anything that these echoes of the past means so much to us, you know, they matter, and they don't have a, there's no worth to it. It's priceless to us to not touch it, not own it, to stand next to Harriet Tubman's handkerchief. That felt very special to me. And I, again, I hope that one day, you will go and visit and learn about your people, if you're black, or your brothers and sisters, if you're not.
There's probably very few experiences in your life that would be worth your time more
than this one.
Than this one.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter. I remember I saw a man there. He was an older white man. This was right around the Harriet Tubman thing where her handkerchief was. And I saw him there, and he didn't know me. I didn't know him, but we were kind of in the same traveling group. We had just gone through the slavery exhibit, and, you know, so now it's just like, look, man, we're all in this together, right? That feeling is there. And I saw he was really taking it in. And I didn't grab him, but I kind of like touched him, and I was like, hey, man, and remember, he's old, gray hair. He looked like a politician, a lawmaker, whatever, you know, one of those types of people, right? And I'm like, hey, man, I just want to say thank you for coming to this. And he's like, you're thanking me for coming to this? And I was like, yes, man, I don't suppose that you have to be here. I don't suppose that if you don't want any of this stuff to mean anything to you, then it won't.
Do you think he was American? Because when he started talking back to you, he seemed to have a bit of an accent.
Maybe.
And he also seemed gracious.
Yeah.
Like, caught off guard initially, because he said it out loud. You're thanking me.
Yep.
but I think as he started to understand the gravity of why you were expressing that, that it hit him in a way too. And that was one of many interactions sure. that stood out on that day.
So, I mean, it means a lot to me. Like, I'm not, what is it? What the thing? I'm not a woman, but I do my best to be as supportive of women's issues as I can be. It just so happens to be the case that I'm Black, but if I was not Black, I would be very supportive of Black people because I recognize that there's forces that artificially suppress what would otherwise be the trajectory of Black life, culture, experiences in this country. You know what I mean? And so anybody who steps outside of their comfort zone to help someone else, I love that because I think that I'm that type of person. So it's really easy for me to thank folks who are not Black in the Black History Museum. Okay, so moving on. I want to, there's a wall there with a, like a quote etched into it. It's from Maya Angelou. It says, "Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave." So now we're kind of moving away from slavery past the Civil War. And there's where another etch on the wall there, another phrase etched into the wall. And it's, we call it the Black National Anthem, but it's lift every voice and sing. And something special happened because we walked past it and there was a group of people who had just walked up to it. And so we're on a different level, but it's in kind of an open area. So we're not with them at all. But we heard them singing it down there, a group of maybe 3-4 women. And it's a museum, mind you, very quiet in there. But the blackest thing ever happened, right? They started to sing. The lyrics are on the wall. They started to sing it, right? And so we're up at the top, me and Q, and we had our partner Chris with us. He was filming. So we're up there. So they needed some bass.
They needed some tenor.
Yeah. So we started to join in and sing, lift every voice and sing with them. There's no music. There's nothing. It's just, this is such a difficult show for me to do, man. I'm doing my best, you guys. Thank you for listening. I normally have it, but this is a lot. They started singing. So we started singing and then other people started singing. And in this giant open space where people are having this experience,
the acoustics were fantastic.
Yes. And we're just singing this song and people are joining in and nobody's shushing us. It was very, very Black experience. I'm grateful that that happened in my life.
I just noticed the last part that you said. No one had a problem with us singing mm-hmm. in this very sacred, very quiet, mm-hmm. Very revered space. Mm-hmm. Not only did no one have a problem with it, but as you said, yeah, you know, more and more people would stop and lend their voice to us.
I would guess that wasn't the first time that's ever happened. Mm. And I would guess that's not the last time that's going to happen. This history that we talk about is very difficult, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. Mm. It's beautiful. I'm so proud of these people that had short lives. Anyway, now we're talking about segregation. So, you know, there's all these signs. They actually have the signs, you know. The waiting rooms for whites only by order of the police department. You know, we went into a train. There's an actual train that was a segregated
train car.
Train car. So you get a chance to see what the white part of the train section look like and the white bathrooms and where the white people put their luggage and how their seats are set up. And then the black part of the train car and how it's very different and very small. Of course, it's not equal. And I'm sure you would assume that. But we had a chance to go through a period. I don't want to even say period correct. It's like the literal train car that was restored. And so we had a chance to check that out as well. And then right after that came the Emmett Till exhibit, because this was the precursor to the civil rights movement. For those that don't know, when Emmett Till died, that kind of supercharged the civil rights movement that came in the 60s in the United States. That one was very difficult. So Q, why don't you take this one? Because I'm running out of steam here. That's why there's two of us on this show. I don't want to be crying in front of y'all.
Very recently, the sequel to Black Panther came out. Mm-hmm. And I actually got invited to a private screening for that film. And afterwards, I was talking to a journalist about what I thought the director's intentions were with how we should feel when we saw that movie, because the reviews were mixed. Some people were disappointed, some people were upset, some people were even angry for reasons that didn't make much sense to me, but you know, people have their reasons. There is a scene in that movie, however, when the daughter of the queen is taken on a mission, and the queen really insisted that she not be taken. Insisted that she not go, because the worst possible outcomes she knew she would not be able to bear. And somehow that moment in watching that film reminded me of Emmett Till's story and his mother not wanting him to go and visit his relatives in the South, because it was not a mystery how Black people were treated all over the country, but more specifically in the South. And I'm going to intentionally avoid the details of how Emmett Till was murdered. Google Emmett Till, read his story, say his name, look at the face of a child that never got to be older than the picture that you're going to see when you Google him. He's probably 14 years old on that picture that you're going to see. Yeah. But his mother is such...
Capital G.
His mother admitted some things that she never really had to. Right, that she was dismissive almost of the trouble of Black people in the South, like that's their problem, it's not ours kind of thing. And she admitted after losing her son that she'd taken a very calloused and kind of selfish approach to the plight of the Southern Blacks, that she had a much different experience in Chicago where she lived. But she made the heroic, selfless decision for Emmett's funeral to be open casket so that people could see the gruesome, disgusting, and terrifying way this child was murdered, and that they would all have to feel and reconcile with not just the injustice, but the inhumane treatment of people that looked like us in this country at the time. And we walked into this exhibit where there were no photos allowed, and saw this small casket intended for a child, and really collectively had to figure out how to emotionally reconcile and continue through the museum. Because I don't think we were prepared when we turned that corner for there to be a casket in there.
That was what we were going to see.
And if you walked up close enough,
you could see him.
You could see the photograph of his face. And that I personally was not prepared for.
And that's all that we have time for today, but suffice it to say, the museum goes on. There's lots of joyous, wonderful things there as well. Lots more history. And our hope is that you make the time, you take the trip, and you learn. So please do. But now it's time for the Way Black History Fact. Today's Way Black History Fact is sponsored by the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. And today's reading comes from whitehousehistory.org. As promised, we're talking about Benjamin Banneker. So I will read. Benjamin Banneker, a free African-American man living in a slave state in the 18th century, never knew the weight of iron shackles or the crack of an overseer's whip. A native of Baltimore County, Maryland, his experience diverged from those of most African-Americans living in the early United States. He received a formal education during his youth, maintained his property and farm as an adult, and parlayed his intellectual gifts into national prestige. Despite his many accomplishments, however, Banneker was forced to navigate the same racial prejudices that African-Americans often faced in both slave and free states. In many ways, his story is a historical anomaly. He assisted with the initial survey of Washington, D.C., published abolitionist material south of the Mason-Dixon line, and engaged with some of the country's founders in a way no black man had before. However, Banneker's life also reflects the defining paradox of the early United States. Is that word again? Paradox. Mm-hmm. A land of freedom and opportunity with insurmountable racial qualifiers, which the nation's capital would come to embody. Born on November 9, 1731, Banneker grew up on a 100-acre tobacco farm owned by his parents, a formerly enslaved man and the daughter of a mixed-race couple, along the Patapsco River in the area now known as Ola. As African-American homesteaders, the family experienced not just freedom, but also a quintessentially American vision of independence and economic self-determination that was rarely possible for non-whites. Still, the color of their skin alienated them from the community of nearby farmers. Amid a rising tide of sentiment against free blacks in the colonies, Banneker's family had to tread lightly in their own neighborhood. Nevertheless, Benjamin received an education that was uncommon, not just for his race, but for his geographic location, where literacy was relatively low. His grandmother, an Irish-born former indentured servant, taught him how to read and write, and Benjamin continued his studies alongside both white and black classmates at a one-room school nearby. His hunger for knowledge went beyond the classroom. In his early 20s, Banneker gained local admiration by hand-carving wooden clock that kept perfect time. He had studied the gears of a pocket watch to master the mechanics. There would not have been many clocks in rural Maryland in the mid-18th century, and Banneker's was later referred to as one of the curiosities of the wild region. Though Banneker hosted many visitors who came to see the clock, it took him years to find an intellectual community. In 1771, the Ellicotts, a Quaker family from Pennsylvania, moved to Baltimore County and established a grist mill just a few miles down the road from Banneker's tobacco farm. Perhaps owing to his reputation as a man of letters or due to his curiosity about construction of the mill, Banneker soon connected with his new neighbors, in particular George Ellicott, a land surveyor with a passion for astronomy who loaned Banneker technical books and lunar tables. Banneker had already sold off some of his land to finance his retirement, and since he was spending less time on the farm, he quickly mastered the discipline. In 1789, the year he turned 58, he forecast his first eclipse. Meanwhile, the stars were aligning for Banneker on Earth. On July 16, 1790, Congress passed the Residence Act, establishing a new federal city to be constructed along the Potomac River. President George Washington appointed three commissioners to oversee its construction, and Andrew Ellicott, George's cousin, was brought on as practical engineer. Needing assistance on the project, and with his unusual associates otherwise occupied, Andrew invited Banneker to join him in mapping out the future seat of the federal government. It was the first time in his life Banneker ventured more than 10 miles from his home. Letters from Ellicott show that in February 1791, he set out with Banneker and several field laborers for Jones Point, Virginia, to plot the boundary lines of the nascent federal city. Because of his age, health, and the harsh winter climate, Banneker's primary responsibilities were in the observatory tent, where he maintained the regulator clock using a series of thermometers and a transit altitude instrument. Each day, Ellicott would use the regular clock to set his own timepiece, which he would use to determine latitude. At night, Banneker would record astronomical observations. He was paid $2 a day for his work, less than Ellicott's $5, but commiserate with salary for an assistant surveyor at that time. President Washington and Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, whose 1785 book Notes on the State of Virginia stated that people of African descent were intellectually inferior to whites. We're aware of Banneker's participation. Meanwhile, an article about the survey in the Georgetown Weekly Ledger praised Banneker's abilities. Ellicott is attended by Benjamin Banneker, an Ethiopian whose abilities as surveyor and an astronomer clearly proved that Mr. Jefferson's concluding that race of men were void of mental endowments was without foundation. And that's a quote from the Georgetown Weekly Ledger. On April 15, 1791, the commissioners Ellicott and spectators took part in a ceremony at Jones Point to install the first of four stone markers that would mark the corners of the federal district. While Banneker was not mentioned in any of the reports from that day, he undoubtedly would have attended. In April 1792, about a year after Banneker returned to his farm, Washington's appointed commissioners initiated the practice of renting enslaved laborers from their owners for capital building projects, mostly to cut labor costs. The work of enslaved people thus underguided the construction of the capital, whose territory Banneker had helped survey. From the clearing and paving of roads to the quarrying and transporting of stone to the building of the White House and the Capitol building. A free black man who was self-made, who was surveying the future capital, would seem to align with the American ideals of individualism and equal opportunity. But the epic construction projects for which Banneker helped plant the first stake were carried out heavily on the backs of enslaved laborers, people of common descent who were explicitly denied those ideals. In this sense, Banneker lived at the center of conflicting stories about the founding of the United States, a contradiction that Washington, D.C. epitomized. Moreover, his interactions with whites, from abolitionists like Rittenhouse to a slave owner like Jefferson, show that even free blacks never escaped the confines of race. While he has rightfully been held up as an example of African-American excellence, Banneker's presence at this ideological crossroad and his persistence through it also makes his story definitively American, with no qualifiers warranted. And so we thought that that was also important to share. And of course, the museum, or sorry, the National Museum of African American History and Culture has quite a bit to say about him as well, because it's based in DC, which of course is where Banneker is now most known for making an impact on this country. And that, among many other reasons, you know, the exhibit on the Red Tails, the exhibit on the Civil Rights Movement, the BLM movement, the music, the food, the fashion, all of it is there, and the contributions are immense. And I really do hope that you get a chance to see it. But that's going to do it for us here on Civic Cypher. So once again, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. Thank you to the Smithsonian for having us. We can't wait to go back, because the few hours we spent there just wasn't enough.
Not at all.
So we're looking forward to visiting again in the very, very near future.
Yeah. And, you know, they told us that it takes 2 days to see everything. They said that you won't get out of there in less than 5 hours, and they were right on both accounts. So for those of you who feel like you have that, there's something missing, or maybe you want to know more, either way, check it out. And with that said, that's it.
So subscribe, any like, questions, share, yeah, comment.
Website, civiccypher.com. Follow us on all social media at Civic Cypher. Download, listen in previous episode. And until next week, y'all.
Peace.
Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spit tuned from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists were journalists too. We can strike.
strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander, here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show, get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse and resist.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This program is made possible by KBOO listeners and Emporium Presents, bringing classic rock band Little Feat to the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland on July 27th. Tickets and information for Little Feat on July 27th are available at portland5.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-supported, listener-powered radio. You can contribute and keep this radio station alive at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. We got a special hour of pop-up programming now. I'm your host, The Incredible Kid. It's a special called Incredible Funk and Soul, and who knows, maybe even some funky disco. Up first, we're going to hear an absolutely amazing band. I've seen the band referred to as Ebony, and I've seen them referred to as Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. So you can either believe that the band is Ebony or the band is Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. Either the album's called Rhythm Funk Campaign or it's a self-titled album called Ebony.